Hey, good morning, everybody. You're listening to KCAW Sitka. This is the Talk of Southeast Alaska, a call-in radio show for you, our listeners. I'm your host, Becky Myers. To join in on our program, call 747-5877. So good morning, everybody, and thank you for joining us here on Raven Radio. Today, our focus will be on natural defoliator outbreaks, forest health, and the risk of wildfires and other impacts on our communities. What do you need to know to be firewise and aware of the risks? We will be taking listener calls throughout the conversation, so please call us with your questions at 747-5877. Despite living in Southeast Alaska, we all know that we're in a rainforest, that the area is exempted from burn bans. We have so many trees, but there are still regional wildfire risks. And if you've been on Admiralty or Kuprianoff Islands, you'll know that, or you'll have noticed the wide swaths of brown forest in the past years. So today we're really lucky to have Elizabeth Graham, entomologist with the U.S. Forest Service in Juneau, joining us today. She'll be joining us right now to describe some of the natural variables that threaten or are a part of a healthy forest cycle. Hi, Elizabeth. Are you there?
Yes. Hi. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for joining us today. We're glad that you can share a little information about this. So I mentioned a big word, this defoliator outbreak. Could you explain a little bit about that and what you do for the Forest Service?
Yeah, thanks for having me today. So a defoliator outbreak is often, it can be caused by one insect or several insects. And in the forest, we have lots of different species of insects that feed and munch on the needles and leaves of trees. And occasionally those populations get very large to the point where we see massive impacts from their feeding damage. And the last couple of years in Southeast Alaska, we had a major defoliator outbreak from the hemlock sawfly, which is a native sawfly to Southeast Alaska, and its population just grew so large that the impacts were quite substantial.
So you are studying bugs, essentially, and this particular bug, this insect, the hemlock sawfly, it is making things drier. Is that correct?
Well, no, the insect isn't making things drier. So I actually, I am an entomologist, and my focus is on forest pests, and I work for a part of the Forest Service called Forest Health Protection, and our mission is to monitor the health of the forest. And so what we noticed these last couple summers is the populations of the hemlock sawfly began to increase quite exponentially. And part of that was actually driven by the drier climate. So the sawflies didn't cause the drier climate, but what happened is there's a fungus that usually keeps the sawfly population levels down. But because it was so much drier in Southeast than it typically is, that fungus wasn't able to grow. And so the sawfly populations grew instead.
So then it sounds like the sawfly is kind of a part of this natural cycle, so to speak. So it is here in forests, typically, and there are other natural causes that seem to mitigate the population or the effect that they have on the forest. Are the hemlock sawflies alone in what they do to trees?
No, there's quite a few different species out there. We have different sawflies that feed on trees, and there's different species of sawflies that feed on different species of trees. We also have lots of caterpillars that like to feed on trees. There are aphids. There's, you know, one of the things that we did for surveying the defoliators is we actually place a white sheet underneath a branch and whack on it, and it's called a beading sheet. And then you look at all the stuff that falls underneath it, and it's just amazing the amount of diversity that you can see just off of one branch.
Well, that's
and then if you think about it, these critters are then going to be a food source for other animals and birds and, you know, small rodents and things like that. And They also contribute to nutrient recycling in the forest, and they play a role in creating those different forest dynamics.
That's true. Besides being a potential food for predators or other organisms living in the forest, how else would the hemlock sawfly and other insect populations contribute to the health of a forest? You had mentioned that it's a part of the health, but they have droppings, right? That matters, and that does something to the forest too. What is that called?
Yes. One of the side effects of this major outbreak is we had lots of reports of people hearing what sounded like rain coming down in the forest when we'd have sunny, clear skies. And what that was actually is the sawflies feeding, and all of their droppings, which we call frass, are just showering down on the forest floor. And while some people might not feel very comfortable with that idea, what that actually is nutrient recycling. And so they're munching on those old needles and then dropping nutrients back into the forest floor. And so the impacts of their defoliation can be really dramatic, especially, visually. And, there's areas you mentioned, like Admiralty Island was really noticeably impacted. And hopefully in most places, the trees will be able to recover, because what's interesting about the sawflies is they only feed on the older needles of the hemlock trees, and they typically will leave those new needles alone. And trees are amazingly resilient. And so if they're able to hold on to those new needles, they're still able to photosynthesize and produce their own food and able to hold on. So they may not grow a lot this year and the next couple of years, but actually eventually, thanks to all those extra nutrients that are going to get added into the soil, as long as they're able to withstand, they can, will eventually rebound and grow even more. The biggest concern is that you mentioned that there are other defoliators in the forest, and we have another species called the western black-headed budworm, and that one is actually a caterpillar that turns into a small moth. And it feeds on the new growth of hemlock trees, and so those new buds. And so our biggest concern is that we don't want to have an outbreak of both of those insects at the same time, because that would be a double whammy where the trees are completely defoliated and may not be able to recover.
So at the moment,
fortunately, when we did our survey, we didn't find many of those. So that's the good news. Sorry.
No. My follow-up question was going to be just about that. So in all of the large swaths of browning forest, the news is not all terrible. The hemlock sawfly is what's causing that, but there aren't as many of the ones that are the insects you just mentioned. And I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the name, but they aren't as present. And so it's not the end of the forest when you see it. At this point, right?
Well, that's what we're hoping. And right now, it's still a little early to tell. Here in Juneau, the hemlocks are just about to bud burst. I've seen the large buds. And what we're going to be looking at next with our team is to look at how much of the trees are able to recover and produce new needles this year. And one of the things we may find in areas that are really heavy defoliated is that they may lose the tops of their trees, that those may not recover, but they'll still keep a full middle, lower crown. And if you look at old, hemlock forests, you see a lot of dead tops. So that's not too uncommon here. So we're really hoping that most of the trees will recover, but I'll probably hopefully be able to tell you a little bit better later this year.
Yeah, I was just about to ask. So I know that monitoring the forest's health, there are a number of different ways to do that. You had mentioned going out in the field and beating the branches in order to see what comes from the trees. What are some other ways that you and your team are monitoring forest health in general?
One big factor of our program is aerial surveys. And so we fly in float planes at lower elevations, just to kind of look at the forest from above. And what we're looking for is different damage signatures, and different insects kind of produce a unique damage signature, whether it's a bark beetle that killed a tree, or a porcupine, that's not an insect, but we can see that from the air as well, the damage that they cause. And here in Southeast, we often see something called yellow cedar decline, and we map that from the air as well. And then this hemlock sawfly outbreak last summer, that was pretty much, they spent most of the survey in Southeast recording the damage from that. We also have been moving into other methods, such as using remote sensing techniques. And one of my colleagues has been working at looking at the signature using satellite imagery and detecting that damage. And that's something that we can, you know, look at a much larger area and don't have to have someone physically in a plane recording. Well, but really, there's nothing better for me than being on the ground and, you know, hitting the trees and seeing what comes out of them.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, that is eyewitness proof of what's in the trees and what's happening to the forest. I had no idea that porcupine damage could be so visible from so far away and that it's that extensive.
Yeah, you know, they definitely like the fastest growing, the nicest looking trees. The foresters hate them for that. And they usually, you know, chew up on the younger ones up on the tops. And it's just, you kind of get to know the areas the porkies like the most.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, definitely. Well, part of why we're so glad to have you on today is it sounds like it may be too soon as of now to know if the outbreak is continuing into 2020. Is that true?
Yeah, it's, you know, my hope is that we'll kind of go back to a more normal summer in Southeast. There's definitely areas where I would be comfortable saying that I think the outbreak has reached its max. Mm-hmm. And that's mostly because the defoliation was so extensive that most of the larvae starved to death last year. They ran out of food. So they ate all those older needles, and the population can't sustain itself at that level. So usually with these kind of outbreaks, we'll see about 1 to 2 years of heavy defoliation, and then it just, you know, crashes. But that's in certain, like, areas like Admiralty, where, you know, we're in a second year. Juneau really saw its first year of major damage or defoliation last summer, so we might see some more here. And there's other spots that we didn't see much at all, so the population could still be building there. But then that could all change if we go back to normal and have a much wetter summer, because, you know, especially in this next coming month in June and early July, because the larvae the sawflies right now are in egg form. They actually lay their eggs inside the hemlock needles. And so they're, you know, ready to hatch, and then they'll, you know, be right there to start feeding. But if it's a wet environment, that fungus that I spoke about, it's going to start knocking down a lot of those larvae as soon as they start emerging and feeding and stuff. So we really want to have, like, June and early July to be nice and wet. That'll kind of keep them from doing too much feeding damage.
Well, thank you for all the information. If somebody wanted to find out more specifically about the sawfly, where is a good place for them to look online?
Yeah, so we have a website with the Alaska Forest Health Protection Team, and it's a little bit of a mouthful, but it's fs.usda.gov /detail/r10/forest-grassland-health. And you could also just Google Alaska Forest Health, and hopefully you'll get directed there as well. Or Hemlock Sawfly, and that could take you directly to our Hemlock Sawfly page. And we have some of our up-to-date information on there, as well as aerial survey information and other things of that nature.
Excellent. Well, thank you for joining us this morning, Elizabeth. I will be sure to add those links and other information about the hemlock sawfly to our website, kcaw.org, where this whole show will be recorded. Thanks for joining us, Elizabeth.
Yes, and thank you for having me. I'm very happy to share this info with people.
Excellent. Thank you. So today we have a number of guests, but I want to remind everybody this is a call-in radio show. So if you have any questions or concerns specifically around fire safety and forest health, give us a call. That number is 747 58 7-7. What are you seeing in your area that might be cause for concern? I'm also, again, mentioning that we have a number of really great guests today. I have right now Kit Moffitt on the line. I'm going to see if I can, if the technology and the internet all works. Hello, Kit. Can you hear me? Oh, goodness. Let's see. We're still working it out. How about now? Oh, golly gee. Well, let's see. Oh, man. I have you on here. This is the thing. Well, maybe I'm messing up. I'm going to try this in a second. We're going to work out some of these technical things in a moment, but for now, let's hear this. Well, let's see. Let's hear the song from Michael Martin Murphy, Wildfire. Okay, we're going to try this again. Hey, Kit, are you there?
Yeah, I am. Let me get my computer and speaker shut down. In other words, changed it over. I think we've got an echo.
Yeah, hold on. I'll try to hang up
okay,
on...
How does that work?
Yeah, that works a lot better. Thanks for joining us and being flexible. Sorry about the Skype.
Yeah, I apologize for the technical difficulties there, too. No worries.
Well, Kit, you are the fire staff officer for the Tongass National Forest. Could you tell us a little bit about what you do?
Yeah, you bet. So I'm actually the acting fire staff officer for the Tongass. The regular fire staff officer is a gentleman by the name of Tristan Clue-Hardy there in Ketchikan. And he's on a detail as a district ranger in Ketchikan, and I'm filling in behind while he's on that that other job. So my I'm a deputy fire staff officer on the Mount Baker Snoqualmie National Forest in Northwest Washington State. I'm a career firefighter, a couple decades of experience, and I'm an incident management team. So I have lots of experience. I've been to Alaska several times, although never on the Tongass on a wildfire. So a little bit of work on the Tongass has been something that I've been wanting to do for a long time, and I've had the opportunity to do it now.
Well, excellent. Well, thank you for being up here. I am curious, what are some fire prevention strategies used for the Tongass National Forest? We just talked about general sort of forest health, especially around insects and outbreaks in that way. So what are some other strategies that are used on the forest?
Yeah, so we monitor the fire danger across the forest on a daily basis. We have a number of remote weather stations that we keep an eye on. If we get into a condition in which fires are likely in one portion or all of the forest, or otherwise our response capabilities are reduced due to other fires that are occurring either on the forest or in the region or elsewhere, There are a number of things that we can consider. The most extreme of which would be a campfire closure order on the forest. And of course, that was considered last year during the drought conditions we had, but we didn't quite get there on that one. So it's a little bit uncommon, but it's we want to keep all the tools in the toolbox there. We work with our state partners as well, and there was an effort to put into place a statewide fire closure order earlier this season, and Tongass is quite a bit different, so we backed away from that for the Tongass specifically, but we are keeping those conversations going with our state and statewide partners.
Yeah.
Since East Alaska is such a diverse landscape, conditions can really vary a lot from one place to another. So we also we encourage folks to be engaged with local fire departments. We have fire agreements or fire response agreements with quite a few local departments throughout Southeast Alaska, and we encourage folks to engage with those fire departments and determine if there are burn restrictions in place at the local level.
Yeah, that's right. So in this area of Southeast, we're not a part of that statewide burn ban. Right now, there can be fires for your trash pile, for campfires and things like that. But what would you say are for this summer, the concerns that you might have for in regards to forest fires and wildfires in the Tongass?
Yeah, so a couple different things going on there. In the short term, we've had, as you guys are well aware, we've had some periods of hot and dry weather, and we haven't quite completed our green up yet for the summer. And so there are places where we've got these cured dry grasses that are susceptible to fire. And we've had a number of fires on the forest over the last couple weeks, one northwest of Juneau that grew to 15.5 acres, and then another one just before last weekend up around the north end of the forest, and grew to about 10 acres right on the Alsek River mouth there. And so we have had these conditions pre-green up where these fine fuels have dried out and carry fires. So that's our current fire concern. Looking out into the summer, the Climate Prediction Center is calling for about a 40% chance of above normal temperatures for Southeast Alaska, as a whole for June, July, and August. Predictions from the Climate Prediction Center for the same period for precipitation show about equal chances above or below normal rainfall. So what this means to me is our best guess for the season is that we'll have kind of a normal summer in terms of precip, but we're more likely to have some periods of hot weather that will contribute to the drying of fuels and increase the chances of having a wildfire occurrence.
Well, knowing that there could be warmer weather and somewhat similar conditions in terms of wetness for the summer, when people go out to recreate in the Tongass this year, what advice would you give to them? What would you want somebody listening to know as they're out working in the wilderness or recreating or playing or fishing? What should they know to be aware of for fire safety?
Yeah, my message is really to not be complacent. I want folks to know that preventing fires and putting out their campfires is their personal responsibility. In Southeast Alaska, more often than not, the risk of fires is pretty low, and it's easy to kind of be complacent. But we do get conditions that allow fires to occur, like in the past few weeks, and these fine dry grasses have been carrying fires. Or later in the season, when the duff and organic materials in the ground start to dry out, fires can get into those materials and smolder and spread for really long periods of time. And then once that happens, it requires a significant amount of work to put those fires out. So even if they're not a large area, we commit our resources to those nuisance fires, and that prevents them from being available and respond to a potentially different fire in another location that might be more threatening to values. Just think about the fact that Southeast Alaska is a really large place, and we only have a relatively small number of professional wildland firefighters spread throughout the region. They might have to come a long way via boat or aviation to get to respond to a fire. And we're all operating now in this kind of pandemic environment, and so We're not wanting to travel even between small communities any more than we really need to. So just asking folks to be cognizant of that and be responsible for your own actions.
That's great advice. And, you know, I think for folks out there listening, there is, you know, not simply complacency, but I know for me, I've had bonfires on the beach and I've had to work, you know, to make sure that it was out and doused completely. Luckily, the beach sometimes has sand and things like that. But what do you have any other specific advice around how people, just being aware is really important, but it should, like, say if somebody is in the forest, they see a wildfire that might have happened maybe through like a natural means, not that we have many wild or lightning strikes or anything, but if they see something, what should somebody do?
Yeah, you should call that in, and depending on your location in Southeast Alaska, how you call that in, you're going to be more familiar with that than I will, but you should report that fire to the local authorities. The Forest Service does have protection responsibility for all lands in Southeast Alaska. And so any fire that is reported, we'll get that call and then we'll generate an appropriate response, whether that be a monitor response for a very remote wildfire that doesn't threaten any values, or whether it be an aggressive initial attack response. Yeah, so absolutely report wildfires as you see them and make sure that we're aware of them and responding appropriately.
Is there anything else you'd like for folks to know about fire safety in the Tongass for this season?
Yeah, you know, a couple things. I would go back to the basic campfire Smokey Bear messages. If you're going to have a campfire, you know, please keep in mind the tools that you might need to put that fire out. A shovel and a bucket with access to water are great things. Those are the really basic messages. And, of course, when you put out a campfire, please take the time to make sure that it's dead out. And that does mean turning that stuff over and getting into all those hot embers and putting that out to where it's cold to the touch, to the back of your hand. Those things are really important, especially if you're having a campfire in a location where fires haven't been, like on the beach often where there's a fire ring and you're in a spot where fires have happened lots of times in the past. There's not a lot of organic material around there for that to spread. We still expect folks to put those fires out, but it's especially important when there's organic material around, or if you're actually in the woods with a campfire, really take the effort to put those things out, because they can smolder for a long time and then get into those organic materials in the duff and the soil, and then we pop back up and we have to respond to those a number of days or even weeks later. You know, the other thing in terms of our response this year during a pandemic, you know, we're going to respond to fires pretty much like folks are used to seeing most years. If there's a value at risk, we're going to respond with an appropriate resource. But we are trying to be really cognizant and deliberate in moving resources around the geographic region, knowing that every time we move someone around between a small village or a town or even to the rest of Alaska, we're exposing our firefighters and also residents in those communities to the coronavirus. So we're really taking that serious this year. We're not quite in a business as usual mode, but we are making decisions, those risk decisions, and moving folks around when it's appropriate to do so. So that's the other thing, you know, when folks, we're asking folks to reduce our workload for nuisance fires so that we can more appropriately manage the fires and move folks around for the fires that are really important and really threatening values.
So it sounds like this season, more than ever, it's important to be aware of the impacts of your fire to make sure that it is completely out. Do you have any advice for folks that might be living a little further out that may have a burn pile or anything like that? What should they try to do?
Yeah, you know, just be extra cautious with that, with those, with that kind of work. Please make sure that there's not a local restriction in place where you're at before you put fire on the ground to burn a slash pile or anything like that. And then have the resources on hand that you need to make sure that you keep that fire contained and to be responsive to that fire if you should get a spot and it should start to spread. And then, of course, you know, if you are engaging in that kind of work, We really ask that you're cognizant of the conditions and timing that work with the appropriate conditions that are not going to be conducive to the spread of that fire.
Right. So if it's a beautiful, breezy day, be careful of the breeze.
You bet, exactly. You know, and it's really easy to just kind of let those things go. Just a couple weeks ago, we had the Crow Point fire out by the Boy Scout camp a few miles northwest of Juneau. And the cause of that fire is under investigation. We assume it was a human-caused fire. There were people in the area that day. And, you know, I think it's a pretty innocent thing when people are out on the beach camping and there's some dry grass around and they had a campfire and it got a little bit breezy and it got away from them. When the Forest Service folks showed up with a helicopter to respond to that fire, there were campers that were out there that were actively trying to suppress the fire, doing their best, you know, there. But it was just an innocent thing that that folks weren't really thinking about, weren't really prepared for. And before that fire was contained, it grew to 15 and a half acres right there on the beach. So just something to keep in mind and be thinking about. You know, I want to throw out one other thing, and it's a little bit unusual for Southeast Alaska, but we had a drone that showed up to film that fire that occurred northwest of Juneau. We don't know who was operating that drone, but as soon as that drone was spotted in the air, we had to ground our aviation resources because those are a life safety threat for those pilots. And so our response with the helicopter and water buckets on that fire was delayed due to that drone showing up in the air. We had to immediately tell our pilot to sit down and wait until we had cleared the airspace. So there's a campaign out there called If You Fly, We Can't. And so if you see a wildfire and you're a drone operator, please just expect that there will be aviation response to that wildfire, particularly in Southeast Alaska, since everything is so far away. Most of our fire response involves some kind of aviation. And if you put a drone up in the air around a wildfire, you're putting the pilots and our firefighters at serious risk of a fatal incident if there was an air collision to occur. So we're just asking for folks to think about that. So thanks.
Yeah, so it sounds like there may be, you know, aside from, you know, not flying, there may be consequences if it seems that a nuisance fire is caused by somebody's actions. I mean, what happens after that fire is out and then you're looking around to determine the cause of the fire, and if you find that it was human intervention that started it?
Yeah, so I can't speak too much to the details of those. We turn those cases over to law enforcement, and they handle them for us. So I'm a fire response expert.
Oh, that makes
not
sense.
An expert, but certainly we do turn all those over. We preserve, in our response to fires, we preserve evidence of the cause of a fire to the extent that we're able, and then we turn those things all over to fire investigators and law enforcement, and they conduct their investigations, and when appropriate, they follow up with charges and court cases.
Well, it's good. More things to keep in mind. Please don't fly your drones. Please be mindful of the conditions where you have a fire and know that, you know, the law enforcement at some point may be engaged in this process. Is there anything? So and for me, I know that we don't have so many wildfires here. I've been living in Oregon for quite a while, and I appreciated hearing on the news when there would be a fire or you would probably just notice it going outside. Is there a website or any place where people can go to see if there are any active burns happening here in Southeast or any active wildfire activity?
No, there's not a good one necessarily that's public facing for Southeast particularly, but I can provide for larger incidents. There is a national website that I can provide you the link to. I don't have it offhand. I can certainly follow up, and you can post that on your website.
Yeah.
InfoWeb is a site that I'm thinking about. So when we get large project fires, those fires that generate a lot of public interest and have a lot of stakeholders and folks involved, lots of good information gets posted on InfoWeb, and I'll follow up with that website address for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll make sure it's posted with this episode. Thank you so much for joining us, Kit. Did you have anything you'd like to leave our listeners with before we part ways?
No, just please, like I asked, please just think about the conditions that are out there when you're out there burning your slash pile or enjoying your campfire on the National Forest, and enjoy your summer.
Thank you so much for joining us, Kit.
Thank you, Becky.
So part of overall forest health is the awareness of conditions that cause dryness that may create the real environment and potential to have wildfires in Southeast Alaska. Another part of it, though, is knowing as a property owner or somebody that interacts with, you know, forests on a regular basis, or you have a house in the forest, to know what resources are available to you as you plan to be fire wise this season. I'm going to see if we have, Trevor on the line. Trevor, are you there?
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Oh, we can hear you perfectly. That's so wonderful.
Fantastic.
You're here. Yay. Well, I'd like to introduce Trevor Doble Carlson for joining the show. He's joining as the program manager for the Forest Stewardship Program of the Alaska Division of Forestry. Trevor, could you tell folks a little bit more about the overview of the Forest Stewardship Program?
Yeah, so the Forest Stewardship Program, it's nationwide. It exists in all states and U.S. territories, and it's actually federally funded. The U.S. Forest Service has a branch called State and Private Forestry, and their goal is to help private forest landowners receive technical forestry assistance, and they do that through the State Division of Forestry in this case. So nationwide, there's about 23 million acres of private forest land that are being managed under the stewardship program. Here in Alaska, we have about 3.5 million acres mm-hmm. in the program, and all those private acres add up to produce a whole lot of public benefits, such as clean drinking water, or recreation, or wildlife habitat, or sustainable forest products. So, private forest landowners play a huge role in all of those public benefits.
Indeed. And so I want to introduce the concept of active management to folks here in Southeast who may be private landowners or part of organizations that steward a bunch of land. What does that mean, active management?
Well, when we're talking about actively managing your forests, we're really encouraging landowners to, just take an active part in their property. You know, it's one thing to just let forests grow naturally, life will grow and take control of itself. But you can take some simple steps on your property to benefit wildlife. You can reduce wildfire risk for yourself and your neighbors. You can plant trees or transplant them. You can increase the overall forest diversity. There's a lot of things that you can do to manage your property to get the most out of it, to get the most visual beauty and scenic appeal and recreation out of it. So we really encourage people to not only manage their land for themselves, but for all of those public benefits that society receives from all the privately owned forests.
And speaking of encouragement, I'd like to encourage our listeners out there to give us a call if you have questions for Trevor and for Kit. I think he's still around. The number here is 747-5877. Again, 747-5877. If you live in the woods, if you have your own homestead and area and you have questions about what this forest stewardship program looks like, give us a call and we'll put you on the air. Again, the number is 747-5877. Trevor, so who do you typically work with? Who qualifies for the programs that you administer?
Yeah, we work with two different types of landowners. First are the individual private homeowners with at least a few acres of forest land. We do only have three staff for the whole state. I manage the program, and then I have two service foresters. So because of our small size, we do try to focus on owners of at least 7 acres just to get the most conservation impact. However, for communities that are outside of our normal service area, if we can schedule multiple property visits for this, as many interested people as possible over a single work week, then we can easily justify traveling and serve owners of smaller properties. So I'm happy to assist any forest land owner in the state. Mm-hmm. Our second type of landowners we serve are the native corporations. We work with them to help them sustainably manage their large ownerships. Their goals are often different from what smaller landowners might have. They're very interested in, for example, the carbon credit market, mm-hmm. such as the regulatory carbon credit market in California. We've helped them sell carbon credits. So we work with both types of landowners, and anyone who owns forest land is eligible for this program.
Excellent. So if someone were to request help, what kind of stuff do you do? What does that look like for somebody?
Well, ideally, we would schedule a property visit so we can walk through the forest with the homeowner, talk about their goals, what they want to see, what they want their forest to look like, and we can show them, you know, in person tips on how to improve wildlife habitat or reduce wildfire danger. Mm-hmm. There's not all the time we can accommodate a one-on-one site visit, so we do work remotely via email consultation, telephone calls, and photos. Mm-hmm. Our end document is a forest stewardship plan. These are free documents. They're non-regulatory, non-binding. Mm-hmm. They will guide the landowner through the next 10 years of managing their forest step by step, and just help figure out how to reach whatever goals they might have.
So the forest stewardship plan you're talking about, that's a long-term kind of thing that not only talks about, you know, how to improve the forest's health, but mitigating aspects to forest management on their property, I would imagine. I mean, what is inside of it?
Oh, it covers everything. There's sections on wildlife habitat, sections on wildfire risk reduction, forest health. Some people want to produce more firewood. Some people need to reforest. There's sections on water resources and habitat diversity, mm-hmm. carbon credits, climate issues. Pretty much anything that addresses any sort of natural resource concern or any concern that the homeowner has, we will research and address in the stewardship plan.
So there's a diversity of different approaches depending on what your goal for the forest might be then.
Absolutely. And pretty much no two landowners have the same goals, have the same visions for what they want their forest to look like, or the same reasons for owning forest. You know, most private forest landowners own land for recreation or legacy or scenic purposes or privacy, but your neighbor might own land to grow timber for harvest. So everyone's goals are different, and we work to help landowners meet their goals.
Excellent. Well, one of the reasons why we were connected was because of the FireWise. I learned about this concept at a conference for rural sustainability and wanted to put the idea of FireWise out there for our listeners and to maybe explain the concept of what defensible space might mean. Could you explain that for listeners?
Absolutely. So FireWise is kind of our secondary goal of the stewardship program here in Alaska. It's how we get boots on the ground in a lot of cases as we talk about wildfire risk reduction. So FireWise is also a nationwide program, and it teaches homeowners ways to manage their property to reduce their risk of wildfire, to protect them and their neighbors. And regardless of what type of forest you live in, even a rainforest or a perpetually rainy area, it may eventually face some sort of wildfire danger when a drought occurs. So FireWise just helps landowners learn how to, you know, mitigate wildfire risk. Simple things like if you have evergreen trees, you know, keep them pruned so their limbs don't touch the ground. Don't store flammable materials under your deck or against your house. A lot of people don't think that, you know, most homes that are lost in a wildfire, they're not ignited from the actual flames. They're ignited from the embers that can be airborne often a mile or more in front of a fire. So we just recommend every year just taking a look around your home, figuring out what is flammable and what, if an ember landed on it, what could ignite and damage your home. FireWise really emphasizes defensible space. And that is a space that the homeowner has maintained where a wildland firefighter or a team of firefighters could come in, stage up, and defend your property from an approaching fire. So there's two things we like to say. One is that, you know, a homeowner can't control what's going on in the forest 2 miles from their house. It could be owned by a national forest or, you know, multiple private landowners. But you can control what your vegetation looks like on your property, what is flammable on your property. And we also like to say, as firefighters, that we can't do in 20 minutes of work what a homeowner should have done in 20 years. So this means don't wait for a drought, don't wait for a high fire danger season to keep your property maintained.
So that property maintenance, it goes hand in hand with having an appreciable amount of space between your home and potential fuel sources. What does that look like? How big is that? And what should people keep in mind as they prepare defensible space in their area?
Honestly, the first 5 feet from your house are really critical for those embers that I talked about. If you can keep the first 5 feet from your house clear of anything that's flammable, that goes a long ways towards keeping your house safe from a fire. And then working your way out, you know, just taking it in chunks. It doesn't have to be an overwhelming task. Get that 5 feet perimeter taken care of, then go out 30 feet. Ideally, we wouldn't like to see any evergreen tree within 30 feet of your house. It's not always possible. You know, it's nice to live in the woods and have you know, landscaping around your house. So we just like to see anything within that 30-foot zone, well-maintained, well-watered, trimmed, pruned, and then work your way out to 60 feet. You know, think about if you have any dead trees or dead vegetation 60 feet from your house. Just picture anything that you have catching on fire and think about how close you want it to your house, and then treat it appropriately. And then finally working your way out all the way out to 100 feet. Out past that, you have a natural forest, and that's fine. But anything within that 100-foot perimeter from your house, just pay careful attention to it and figure out what it would look like if it caught on fire, and if you want it that close to your house.
So besides the Alaska Department of Forestry, are there other potential partners that landowners could connect with around forest health and safety?
Well, within the Division of Forestry, there's two excellent programs. The Forest Health Program monitors forest pests throughout the state, and the Urban and Community Forestry Program works with communities and public trees, public parks, and public spaces. Besides that, the UAF Cooperative Extension Service has really excellent publications that I depend on in my day-to-day job. Their website is uaf.edu/CES, or you can just do a internet search for UAF Cooperative Extension. Also encourage you to look at the National FireWise USA website. It's part of the National Fire Protection Association. That's nfpa.org. And you can find a whole lot of resources there that will explain FireWise a lot more in depth than what I was able to talk about today.
Excellent. So I'm here again, our dear listeners, to invite you to ask questions to the folks that we have on the line. We have Kit and Trevor still here for any questions you might have about forest safety, about how to protect yourself for wildfires, and what to do to prepare for them. That phone number again is 747-5877. 747-5877. We have just a few more minutes left in the show. We'll be about 3 minutes or so. Is there anything that you would like to let folks know about, Trevor, before we wrap up?
I believe if you, again, do an internet search for Alaska Interagency Coordination Center, AICC, you can get the daily situation report to see what wildfires are burning throughout the state. I just wanted to add that. It can be very helpful to see what's going on throughout the state. And also the forestry.alaska.gov, you can go and find out more info on the stewardship program.
Yeah, I have relied so much on all of the resources that are available on a state and federal level around forest safety and health. So there is a world of excellent information out there, and I am so glad that you were able to join us today. Just as a parting thought, what sort of mitigation strategies would you want to leave with our listeners before we go today?
Basically, try to improve your forest to leave it in the best condition possible. Keep a forest as an intact forest. We really aim to reduce forest fragmentation and keep wildlife habitat intact. And really just enjoy your forest and keep it in a good fire-safe condition.
Excellent. Well, yes, that's the takeaway, folks. Enjoy your forest. We have a lot of it. And Trevor, thank you for all you do in helping folks that have this. It's quite a large area that you you give guidance to for folks that are private landowners. What was that figure again? How large an area was that?
Here in Alaska, over the last 20 years, we've served a little over 9 million acres. Currently, in the last 10 years, which is the current lifespan of the program, is 3.5 million acres.
That's incredible. That's a lot of acres. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Trevor. And I will make sure that all of the information you outlined will be on the website, kcew.org. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So folks, if you have any parting thoughts or if you have any particular strategies you'd like to add, please feel free to give us a shout. That number is 747-5877. Additionally, if you are still thinking about that question, if you are not quite sure what you'd like to ask now, but would later like to talk, you can always email me at the station. I'm generalmanager@kcaw.org. Send your questions if you have any for these fire experts. And today we talked about our fire safety, the general health of the environment that we live in, about insects that are defoliators that are a concern over time. But it sounds like we still have our greening left to do. So this is Becky. Thank you again for joining us today on Talk of Southeast Alaska. And I'm so glad to have been joined by Elizabeth Graham, Trevor Doble, and Kit Moffitt for all of us here at KCAW. Thank you for listening. And if you enjoyed the show, join us for the next one. We're still working out some of the details on that, but it will be great. We will be back next month, and thank you for joining us. Thanks for listening to Talk of Southeast Alaska today. Our producer is Peter Vu. Thanks also to Belly Meat, who made our theme music. If you'd like to be a guest on our next show or have any ideas on topics you would like to hear discussed, contact me, Becky, by calling 747-5877. You can also follow along on our newsletter. Sign up for it on our website. Go to kcaw.org and find the button on the right side of the homepage. An archive of this program will also be available on our website. Talk of Southeast Alaska is a production of KCAW Sitka, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of the Raven Radio Foundation, its staff, or its underwriters. You are listening to KCAW Sitka.